Good evening. Yes, I guess we did. And welcome to the January 2020 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. Welcome, everybody, and Happy New Year. The meeting will be called to order, and our first item on the agenda is public comment. Any persons in the audience that would like to come forward and speak on any issue? The issue should not be something that's scheduled on our agenda this evening, but we're happy to hear your comments. Not seeing the entire room jump up and come up, we will move on to the next item, which is our consent agenda. And the items, we have three items on that. I will be happy to entertain a motion to accept the consent items if somebody would like to do that.
I move.
Thank you, Catherine.
I second.
Thank you, Tamar. Any discussion? All those in favor of accepting the consent items, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passed. Question about the consent items, then the letters will be prepared. I will take the letter to Board of Supervisor tomorrow, and Commissioner Campbell will go to the Morro Bay City Council meeting tomorrow evening and take that letter as well.
Question?
Yes.
Will you be bringing it to the board at the dais and reading it, or will you just be handing it to them?
No, we'll take a copy for them. I will be making public comment as well as Commissioner Campbell will. I probably will not read the entire letter because it's longer than 3 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So I'll pick out some important issues and,
okay,
and bring that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. A couple of updates on some of our previous items that we've been talking about the last few months. Our program on the policy solutions to address our youth vaping on the federal level, January 2 of this year, 2020, the Trump administration announced Thursday that it will prohibit fruit, candy, mint, and dessert flavors from small cartridge-based e-cigarettes that are popular with high school students, but menthol and tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes will still be allowed to remain on the market. The flavor ban will also entirely exempt large tank-based vaping devices, which are primarily sold in vape shops that cater to adult smokers. That's out of the Associated Press. Also, January 1 of 2020, we did raise the age for buying tobacco federally to 21. January 6th, California legislatures introduced a bill that would ban the sale of flavored tobacco products in brick-and-mortar stores, including menthol cigarettes and flavored e-cigarettes. So we might keep track of that and see how that passes through our legislature. On our program for vaccinations for all ages, which was our October meeting, California's elimination in 2016 of non-medical vaccine exemptions from school entry requirements was associated with an estimated increase in vaccination coverage at state and county levels, according to a new study published this week in PLOS Medicine by Nathan Lowe of the University of California, San Francisco, and his colleagues. So that's good news as well. On our housing program that we had in November, I think it was. There are a couple of updates on that from the county, and I will give you those when I report on the Healthy Communities meeting that we had this week. So anybody else have any updates on our previous agenda items? All right. Well, one of the items on our agenda this evening has to do with the upcoming census. And so we have with us Patricia Vasquez, and Patricia will tell us how to pronounce her last name when she comes up. She is the Regional Program Manager for California Complete Counts, the Census 2020. And we are delighted to have you with us this evening. Patricia, thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me and for inviting me to be here this evening. So, good evening. My name is Patricia Vasquez Topete, and I am a regional program manager for the Region 5 counties in the state of California for the upcoming census, and I'll be showing a map of how we've divided up the state to show what consists of the Region 5 in our state for the census. So I just wanted to very briefly share a little bit about the difference of the U.S. Census Bureau and the State of California Complete Count Office. The U.S. Census Bureau, they are really in charge of leading the operational count. So they are in charge of hiring enumerators, hiring the staff who will be leading the count once we approach March 12th, which is when self-response begins for the census. And they'll also be doing the non-response follow-up after April 1st. Our office, the California Complete Count Office, we're really in charge of making sure that the hardest-to-count populations in the state are counted. I'll be showing you a list of the populations that our office considers hard to count as I go further into my presentation. So really, our campaign is an educational and outreach campaign to ensure that we are reaching our hard-to-count populations. It's really education and media, and we're calling it an air and ground game. Air, I'm referring to media. Ground game, I'm referring to all of the partners that we're going to be working with to ensure that the hardest-to-count communities get counted. So the role of the state is really to coordinate the partners, coordinate the stakeholders, coordinate the community-based organizations, the counties, the cities, the educational institutions, and also to identify any gaps that may exist across the state to ensure a complete count of our hardest-to-count HTCs. So why should we care about the census? Why should anybody be interested in ensuring and coordinating with us to get a complete count? I'm glad you ask. It's because there is power and money at play with the census, especially as we approach the census 2020. Each person that fills out their census questionnaire is really connected to funding of about an estimated $1,000 that comes back into our local communities and that our different counties and cities utilize to provide back services to this hard-to-count community. So if we are missing, let's say we're missing 10 individuals, and my office likes to say this, when we are walking down the street, we really think of every person as there's $1,000. If we don't get them counted, services that go to transportation, our different schools in our counties will not be able to receive that funding back into that local community. We're also speaking about congressional representation and redistricting. So these are the two main items that we need to consider as we go out and really spread the messaging with those individuals that we work with in a daily basis, because it is a powerful campaign, and we don't want to lose anyone from being counted in this census campaign. So earlier I was referring to working with Region 5. So if you look at this map, it's the not the bright green color, but the darker green color. And I know it's a little bit small, but San Luis Obispo belongs to Region 5. So we're looking at the counties in the Central Coast from Ventura all the way to Santa Cruz County. So that's the region that I work with. And I'll be talking a little bit about also how we funded the state and divided up these 10 regions. Okay. So the legislature and the office of the governor, they have invested about $187 million to ensure that our hard-to-count communities get counted in the census. So this has been allocated to counties, it has been allocated to educational partners, and it has also been allocated to the 10 regions, and we refer to the 10 regions, the leaders, the ACBOs, Administrative Community-Based Organizations. So that's how the funding has gone out to the 10 regions, and then within the 10 regions, it has also been allocated to each individual county that has opted in to receive funding. Okay, so I'll cover a little bit about the funding strategy. So I will highlight a couple of the bullet points here for you. It's really our funding strategy is to ensure that we are having one-on-one conversations with the hard-to-count communities. We want to ensure that we're investing in the language capacity of the different community organizations, because we know that the hard-to-count are not all English speakers. We know that they speak indigenous languages. We also know that some of our hard-to-count communities may have a disability, so we need to keep that into consideration when developing our strategy to get to our hard-to-count. Like I said, we are investing in media. We want to combat any type of inaccurate information that our communities are receiving. So really, we want to be very quick. If there is misinformation going around, our office wants to get to work and make sure that we develop messaging that corrects that misinformation on the ground. So I want to show who we're working with, who we're partnering with, and being here tonight, we also want to partner and coordinate with all of you, because we know that you work with organizations that are able to interact with the hard-to-count community. So we invite you to partner with us, and we have been already working with counties, and the counties have established local complete count committees. We have been working with regional ACBOs and statewide CBOs. I will show you who the statewide CBOs are. And we're also working with sector organizations, as well as education, CSUs, community colleges, the high schools, the offices of education, the migrant education programs. We're trying to bring everyone to the table and partner with them. Okay. So who are the hard-to-count communities? I wanted to show you this list. I'll just highlight a couple of the hard-to-count communities. We're speaking about our children 0 to 5 who were not counted like they should have been back in 2010. We're speaking about our limited English proficient households. We're speaking about our veterans, our homeless communities, our people with disabilities, amongst other populations that you'll see here. So the state has also created a statewide approach, and you may be familiar with a couple of the organizations that we have listed here. We're working with MICOP, the Mixteco Indígena Community Organizing Project. We're working with the Latino Community Foundation, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights. So all of the hard-to-count populations that I previously went over in my previous slides, we have chosen a statewide organization that has capacity at the statewide level to reach and help us really develop and tailor our messaging to these populations. Our sector's approach, I also wanted to show you that we're also targeting different organizations specifically to serve our children. In the health sector, we are working with the the California Primary Care Association, and I wanted to provide you a little bit more information. CPCA, they have received $250,000 from the state, and they have been tasked with creating an outreach campaign and working with their local health centers across the state to really help us reach out to their clients. So they have been tasked with connecting to their health centers. They are subcontracting out some of this monies with the centers, and they will also be developing a toolkit for the Hard to Count community. Once that toolkit has been released, I'm happy to provide it to those of you who are here at this meeting today. So here I wanted to show you a timeline, and I also wanted to show you where we currently are in this timeline. We are currently in what we call the activation phase. So really, we're trying to activate all of the partners, bring any new partners that need to be at the table, and educating them about the census. So from January to March 11, that's the activation phase. Phase four, which is really March 12, when the U.S. Census Bureau starts to send out postcards about self-response, that is, that's our Be Counted campaign, and it goes until April 30th. And then after that, we will head into the non-response follow-up period for anyone who still has not responded to the census. And if I may highlight, Census Day is on April 1st, 2020. So I also wanted to talk to you. I know I've been speaking about the ACVOs, the statewide CVOs, the counties, among other partners. But really, our campaign is really drawn to the level of who are the trusted messengers in your community? Who are the organizations that serve the Hard to Count? And we really know that it comes down to not just our organizations, but individuals living in the county to be speaking about the census. So the trusted messengers, they are anyone who the community trusts, and anyone who is a credible leader within the community. So we want to equip them to really be the ones that take the education to the community. So any organization, any community member that you know of that's really trusted here in SLO, we want to bring them to the table because we know that that's how the community will hear about the census. So what can you do right now, and how can you partner with us? So I wanted to briefly say our office, along with our media partner, Mercury Public Affairs, we have developed collateral materials, and we have them available for anyone who's interested in receiving more information. We have more information on our website in the top 12 languages of the state of California, and we also have media toolkits that you could use as you begin to really prepare to be talking to the community or the organizations you work with about the census. So I'm happy to provide that link to all of you and send it to Michael to provide to you. We also encourage you to use our census logo, California for All, in your signature block. We encourage you to present a couple of talking points on the census at different meetings that you attend, and we could provide you that information as you're equipped to speak to the community on this very important campaign. We also encourage you to link our website on your organization's website as well, and we could provide that information as to how you could link it and also provide the collateral materials if that's something you're interested in. Here I hyperlink just some different materials that that I thought would be useful. It really goes over some of the information I've spoken about during my presentation. I also provided a hard to count sheet for San Luis Obispo to Michael, if you wanted to see where are the hardest to count geographical hubs within San Luis Obispo County. And then before I get to the end of my presentation, I know I've been mentioning the county a couple of times, so I also wanted to let you know that Kristen Erickson is the staff leading the efforts with the census, and she is here tonight, and I've provided her business card and her information to Michael. She has been leading the census complete count meetings for SLO. So you are more than welcome to reach out to Kristen and get plugged in with the local efforts taking place here within your county. And our office, really, we just want to provide to you anything that you need as you incorporate this campaign into your daily work. So we're a resource, and Kristen is also here to be a resource moving forward.
Thank you. So for our TV audience, Patricia, can you like just maybe two or three bullets how the census works? People should expect the postcard?
Yes. So how the census works is starting on March 12th, different households will begin to receive a postcard in the mail, invited to fill out their census form online. And that will go on until April 1st, and that's when Census Day takes place. So between March 12th and April 30th, the households will receive a total of 4 postcards. And then if by that last postcard they still haven't responded, the U.S. Census Bureau will be sending an enumerator to the different households to knock and really ask them, you know, how come you have still not filled out your census? Can we help you fill out the census today? So we know that there's issues sometimes with opening up the door to someone you may don't know, especially given everything that's been happening at the federal level. So we're encouraging everyone that if you could self-respond prior to April 30th, that would not trigger an enumerator to come to your door. So that's the messaging that that we are communicating. Yes.
And about how long does it take one to do the online?
The online census? Yeah. So it is approximately 10 minutes per individual living in your household.
And you would do one for everybody in the household.
So you fill out a census for everyone who lives at least 50% of their time during the year in your household. So everyone, even if there is someone that lives, there's a premise behind the home and they're living behind your home, you would still count them. So you would still count everyone living in the household on April 1st.
Newborns?
Yes, you would count newborns.
Okay. Any other questions from any of the commissioners?
Yes.
What about the people like in skilled facilities and things like that? Is it through the facility?
So skilled facilities like nursing facilities. So that would be under the group quarters enumeration. And I'm happy to send you some more information about the group quarters enumeration. The U.S. Census Bureau will actually be contacting the nursing facility around February, and they will be connecting with them to see how the staff in that facility would like to count their residents. So that's a different enumeration process. It would be considered a group quarter.
Good. Tamar?
Once the U.S. Census sends over an enumerator to the home of mm-hmm. the person or people who have not yet responded, is there a way to who executes on that? Is that going mm-hmm. to be through your team, essentially, that at the local level who comes knocking on the door, or is that actually someone who's appointed federally and they've got certain people on the ground?
So in regards to who sends out the enumerators, that will be the U.S. Census Bureau. So the U.S. Census Bureau is in charge of hiring enumerators. They are ramping up. And if you also want information about those U.S. Census Bureau temporary positions, we are happy to provide them to you, because we want individuals from the community to be hired to be an enumerator. So we don't want someone coming in from outside to be an enumerator in your county. So that's the U.S. Census Bureau, and they're doing the hiring.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Because I was wondering if someone would be confused if they come in and say, "I represent the U.S. government," and you know whether or not someone would open the door.
And. That's a very great question. So an enumerator from the U.S. Census Bureau will also have a badge with a watermark. And there's also a number that we could share with you, that if any community member has a question, there's a number that they could call to verify that that person knocking in their door is indeed a U.S. Census Bureau enumerator. Because we want to make sure that there is not fraud taking place within our communities.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Catherine?
I guess I had a question about the homeless. How is that being approached? And if we have like a homeless encampment or even a shelter, do you have enumerators that are going and speaking individually to these people?
So there's also going to be a enumeration for the homeless population. My understanding is that the homeless enumeration will take place in the end of March. So at the end of March, and it will go on until April 1st or 2nd. So it's a 3-day enumeration of the homeless population. And I know the U.S. Census Bureau is collecting information from the homeless providers to work directly with them in regards to when they'll be coming out and where the homeless population congregates. So the U.S. Census Bureau is working on that count, and they are connecting with the homeless providers.
Well, thank you for coming this evening. It's very important information. I remember many, many, many years ago, my mother was a enumerator in a very rural county during the winter. And I know one of the things that she shared was it was incredibly hard to get some people to share, and that was surprising. I mean, she knew many of them. They were, you know, our rural neighbors or whatever, but people were just hesitant to share. And I think perhaps they don't understand what we use a census for and you know, why it's so important.
Yes.
So thank you for being here and sharing with us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me here, and we look forward to partnering with you. Thank you.
Thank you. So our next agenda item, Ginger has put together a very good program this evening, and I will ask her to introduce the program and our speakers.
I would love to. Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. Tonight's Health Commission topic will focus on the health impact of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders in San Luis Obispo County. We have a comprehensive set of speakers, including Chrissy Streeper, sharing her personal story of PMAD, Dr. Angela Hulusic, obstetrician from Women's Health. I was told to get the name right. Women's Health First California Physician Partners in San Luis Obispo, which will soon be changing its name to Tenet Health Central Coast. She'll be speaking about the signs, symptoms, and medical intervention. We have Calandra Park, RN from Dignity Health, speaking in regards to the Dignity Health PMAD program. And Brooke Treanor, community health nurse from SLO County, speaking in regards to the SLO County PMAD project, community needs and solutions. And we have Michelle Whitaker, lactation consultant from Tenet Health Central Coast, speaking in regards to the Tenet Health Central Coast PMAD program. And Christy Streeper. Oh, you're first up. Thank you.
All right, I'm Christy, and Ginger asked me to come share my own personal story with you. But a little bit about myself, I guess. I've lived in San Luis Obispo for a long time. My parents went to Cal Poly, so I grew up like camping in Pismo and Morro Bay, and Cal Poly was the only college I applied to, and I got in. And then I did spend a year in Boston for my internship and immediately wanted to come back. And so I've been fortunate enough to be here. I work for Dignity Health, and I've been working at Marion down in Santa Maria for almost 20 years now. So on to my story. You know, I've shared my story, I had like 5 or 6 times, and it just never gets easier, so bear with me. And even though it's been a while, my son, who this happened with, is 10, but it's still, you know, painful and hard. But I will start sharing. My husband and I planned a baby. You know, it's not like it was an unplanned child or anything like that. We were very excited to have a baby. And I delivered, after an uncomplicated delivery, a healthy boy. But in the hospital, it was almost like a switch flipped, and I had immediate anxiety. I was someone who had never struggled with anxiety or depression or any sort of mental health issue before having a child. And in the hospital, it was a little bit, you know, what I consider to be normal anxiety, like, oh, is the baby breathing still, you know, and why is he crying? And there are some jaundice issues, you know, mild jaundice issues. So I remember being obsessed, like, if he'd pooped, you know, like, get the meconium out. And but it was like causing me to not sleep. This anxiety was, even just at a few days old, I thought that I would be able to, you know, sleep when the baby sleeps, but even that early on, it wasn't happening. And as the week turned into a couple of weeks, it started to get worse. I started to have almost visions of things that were happening to my child that really couldn't happen in real life. Like, I remember I had this vision of my son would be laying on a blanket, you know, and then a couch cushion would all of a sudden like fall on top of him and smother him, or a mattress from a bed would go and smother him. So these kind of things that couldn't happen in real life, but they would just kind of be on replay over and over again in my head. And it was definitely interrupting my sleep. And then as I didn't sleep, they continued to get worse. So this is only week 2. I went to see my OB and told her everything that was happening. And I started on a medication called Zoloft, which is a pretty common antidepressant. And I was grateful to take it, but inside I desperately wanted to be a person who didn't need a medication like that. I wanted to power through it, and I wanted to, you know, get this mom thing down and not need something like that. About that same time, my mom came into town, and my mom has a very calming influence on me. And I had my mom like sleep where my son was sleeping at night. And for some reason, my mom, like, I knew my mom, you know, would keep him safe. And so I was able to sleep a little better during the about week that she was there. And at, you know, after that week was done, I thought, I don't think I really need this medication. I just needed a few good nights of sleep, and I think I'm done with this. So I stopped taking the medication, which in hindsight was a bad idea. And weeks 4 or 5, you know, I did not get better. I was continuing to have these things that were just replaying in my mind, and they got worse. And even though it's hard for me to, like, say I think it needs to be said, I would picture my baby in an oven. I would picture my baby in a microwave or a pot of boiling water. And I just couldn't stop it from happening in my head. It was really, like, torture to have to see this over and over again. At that point, week 5-ish, something like that, went back to my OB and started taking the Zoloft again. But I think at that point it had gotten to be too out of control. I have very supportive friends. I kind of forgot to mention that. But I had friends that I was talking to during this whole time, and my husband was very supportive also and freaking out because he was seeing what I was going through. But I had friends who said, well, maybe, you know, come spend the night at our house, and maybe if you're, like, physically separated from your son, then you can get some sleep, because that's kind of what it really was at that time. Like, I was not sleeping. I would sleep, like, maybe an hour or two, and if I did sleep, I would have a horrible nightmare of, like, the visions that were happening in my head, so I would, you know, wake up in a panic. So I tried sleeping in a hotel one night. I tried sleeping at my friend's house a couple of nights. During the hotel night, I remember my husband and I, we had a plan. I mean, we were desperate. I think I was going to take like two Benadryl or something like that. I had already tried like NyQuil. I had tried all these, you know, over-the-counter type things to try to sleep and relax. But at the hotel, I had pretty much what I consider to be a panic attack, where I was just spinning almost. And so I went, the kind of plan was, if I couldn't sleep at that hotel because something like that would happen, I went to the ER. And so I went to the ER, and the physician there, you know, he didn't know how to help me, and I don't blame him or anything like that. That's why we're here, right? Increased awareness. But he said, you know, just try to rest when the baby rests and try to eat healthy and exercise. And I just kind of looked at him like, you know, I'm a dietitian. Oh, I'm a dietitian. I don't know if I said that. I know how to eat healthy and, you know, resting with the baby. This is not working for me. And so he gave me a trazodone, which I think is a tranquilizer, and gave me a number for a hotline to call and kind of sent me on my way. And I did call the hotline, and again, it was unfortunately not very helpful, the same kind of advice to sleep when the baby sleeps and things like that. So I went back to the OB. I was taking the Zoloft, but it hadn't really done anything at that point. Then I had a night where it was, instead of me seeing these things that were happening to my son, like the microwave and things like that, it became me putting my son in those situations, so me that was harming my son. And there was a couple of nights where just, again, sleepless and just tortured by these visions that I was having. And then it was made worse by the fact that it was me in these visions that was harming my son. And so kind of I thought it was a very rational choice, and of course it wasn't because I was not in my right mind, but I thought, well, I'll just kill myself. You know, I don't want to be someone who harms my son. And I had, you know, as clear as day, I'll slit my wrists. That's my plan. So I was sleeping at my friend's house that night, and I told her what was going on, and she's like, we have to go to the ER. And I said, well, they didn't really help me last time, you know. And we have a friend that works in that ER, and she's like, I'm going to call that girl. We're going to take you there. We're not going to let them discharge you until there's a plan in place. So I kind of begrudgingly went back to the ER. But that time it was different. That time I met with a mental health professional who told me, you know, he told me this isn't your fault, which is something that I really needed to hear, and we'll get you help. And from that ER visit, I was sent to Vista Del Mar in Ventura, which is a mental health hospital. And I was put on two medications that immediately helped me the very first night that I was there. I was the happiest person ever to go to a mental hospital because I really didn't want to die, and I really loved my child, and I really wanted to get better. And I spent a week in the hospital, and after that week, I was back to myself. It really was amazing how the right medication helped me get back to myself. I slept, you know. There was therapy sessions there, and I learned that, you know, when you don't have sleep, you cannot, your brain goes haywire. You can't control the thoughts that your brain has. And so I stayed on those medications for about a year and gradually weaned off of them. And I had no problems weaning off of them. And I do always like to add, I have a second son, and that's like on purpose. We tried, you know, again to have another son and another baby. And the plan was for me to go right back on those same two medications after that son was born. And it was a night and day experience. I had no problems with my second child. I was under the care of a psychiatrist who I would see, you know, once a month and refill my prescriptions and everything like that. But I had no problems. It was a very sweet, joyful, you know, newborn time with that son. And again, stayed on the medications for about a year and then just gradually weaned off. So that's my story in a nutshell, and I always like to tell people, yes, it does. It has a happy ending. I'm lucky that I did eventually get the help that I needed. The time that I had in the mental hospital, I feel lucky that there was a bed available. I feel lucky. I know with psych medications, it's pretty much trial and error, so I feel lucky that that doctor picked medications that worked for me right away. And I'm lucky that things didn't get worse. So I'm going to conclude my story now. And
thank you for sharing. That's something that we appreciate you coming in very much and telling us about that. So now maybe some of the rest of our speakers will come up and enlighten us about the services that we do have and how you help some people.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. So yeah, my name is Angela Halusik. I'm one of the OB-GYN physicians at Women's Health SLO First California Physician Partners. And I also have a master's in public health. And again, thank you so much for that story. It's also a great segue into my presentation because that all of the symptoms that you described are all symptoms that we should be looking out for and that us as providers are always looking out for in women who've delivered. And I'll just give an overview of my talk first. So I'll talk about the definition of postpartum depression, I'll talk about signs and symptoms, I'll talk about risk factors, I'll talk about theories in terms of why this happens to women. I'll talk about screening, and we do screen everyone at their postpartum visit, and I'll also talk about treatment. So I just want to bring up this slide just to point out that these women are what makes the media stories. Before I went to medical school and someone would mention postpartum depression, these are the stories that came to my head of women who commit infanticide. And I want to just point out that obviously, this is a horrible, horrible thing. This can absolutely happen with postpartum depression, but it's also very rare. It's estimated to be about 5 to 7 in 10,000 women do this. And so far more common presentations are what I'll talk about and sound more like Christine's story. And so the definition of postpartum depression is depressive episodes that occur within 12 months of delivery. And the 12 months of delivery is quite important just because, because often, usually when women are, a month out, 6 weeks out, people are very good at saying, okay, yeah, this is postpartum depression. But when a woman maybe presents 6 or 8 months out, not everyone makes the link between that episode and postpartum depression. And so really the definition is within 12 months of delivery. And so what are these depressive symptoms? A lot of it's what Christine said. It's feeling down, having harmful thoughts. Anxiety can often be a prominent feature, not being able to sleep even though the baby's sleeping. It can be very heterogeneous. Not everyone has all of these symptoms. Some women just have some of them, and they can just arrange themselves differently. And not everyone's forthcoming with having these thoughts. So I'll talk about screening again later. But there's a wide variety of thoughts. But typically, when they get so bad where they interfere with you being able to function or you being able to take care of your baby, then it becomes quite severe. And so I want to point out the difference between baby blues and postpartum depression. Most women, over 80% of women who deliver, get mood changes after they deliver. They might have changes in eating and sleeping patterns, and this can be totally normal. You would expect that someone who just had a baby is going to have changes in sleeping patterns because now they have a baby to take care of. They're going to also have changes in eating patterns, and they may be sad. They may have a reduced libido. But when most women, when they experience this, it maybe peaks at around 4 days after delivery, and it should get better within 10 days. But when it's more severe, where it's to the point where women can't take care of themselves, they're never sleeping, they have really like deep feelings of shame or inadequacy, maybe they're becoming socially isolated, and those are persistent, that's really postpartum depression. And so why does this happen? There are natural hormonal changes that occur after a woman delivers. There's estrogen and progesterone, which are some hormones that are normal in women, but these levels will decrease after a woman delivers. The reason why some women get postpartum depression and not others is really some people are more susceptible to it. So it's really the combination of the hormonal changes occurring in a susceptible individual. And so what makes someone susceptible, and that's a number of things. Genetics, some people are just more prone to getting depression. Sometimes there's social problems or other stressful life events. Say there are financial problems, a loved one passed away, you had something really traumatic happen in childbirth. These can all set people up for having postpartum depression. And so when you think about all the factors that contribute to postpartum depression, it really makes sense what the risk factors would be. So the risk factors are, you know, someone who's already prone to having depression. So if you've had it before, have depression before at other points in your life, or if you've had postpartum depression before, then that would increase your risk of having postpartum depression. Having, again, stressful life events, having a sick baby, and breastfeeding problems, I just want to point out. So it's not like it's not breastfeeding or not breastfeeding that increases your risk for postpartum depression. It's more if you're breastfeeding and you're having difficulty with breastfeeding. We as a society put a lot of emphasis on breastfeeding, which, you know, for very good reason, because breastfeeding has been shown to have a lot of positive health outcomes. However, when women put so much emphasis on breastfeeding, and then when they're not able to, they blame themselves and think of themselves as inadequate as a mother, then that's really what can set people up for postpartum depression. And so here's just a list of screening questions that we ask every woman at their postpartum visit. The postpartum visit takes place about 6 weeks after a woman delivers. And this particular questionnaire is the most commonly used one. It's called the Postnatal Edinburgh Depression Scale. The great thing about this, it's 10 questions. It's very easy to read. It takes about 5 minutes to complete, and it's available in over 50 languages. And so based on how you score, based on your overall score, or based on how you answer question 10, which is the thought of harming myself has occurred to me, then we would diagnose you with postpartum depression. And then the treatment is exactly what Christine said. Referral to a mental health provider is absolutely important. And there are also a number of medications that we can start people on as well. And those have been shown to be very helpful. And so, again, just if any of you know someone who's contemplating suicide, definitely call your doctor, go to the ER, call 911. I also listed the 24-hour hotline of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And then here I've just included some resources that are places that you can go to read about postpartum depression.
Thank you. Let's have our next presenter, and then we will do questions and answer after we've had all of the presentations.
I just want to say thank you for having me. I'm going to go on to my slide. As it states up there, my name is Brooke Trainer. I'm PMAD coordinator for the County of Public Health PMAD project. I just wanted to start out my presentation on what are PMAD, because it might not be a term. It's very familiar to me because that's my passion, is you know, supporting these women, this population, but it may not be something that you guys are all familiar with. So I have it stated on the state, on the slide here, what are PMAD. So the P in PMAD, perinatal, is the entire time frame from when somebody first realizes they're pregnant up until that first year, 12 months, that they've had the baby. Mood is depression, bipolar, psychosis. So it's an umbrella of disorder where depression is, depression and anxiety are the most common of these disorders, but they do have a kind of a spectrum. And so anxiety is general anxiety disorder, panic, OCD, so obsessive compulsive, and post-traumatic stress are part of this umbrella of disorders, and the D is for disorders. So I thought I'd start out with that, since if you're looking at PMAD saying, what is that? And then another, just a slide on the prevalence. It's the number one complication of childbirth and pregnancy. One in five women experience one of those disorders. It used to be one in seven, and now they've raised the bar to one in five. So it's very prevalent. And 50% of these women don't get the treatment or the care that they need, whether it be they don't disclose what they're going through, or they can't find a therapist or a psychiatrist, or they don't have the insurance to cover it. So half, in fact, don't get the care that they need. So we're working on it with our project. Another slide just mentioning some statistics from 2017. Untreated PMAD nationwide was $14.2 billion for all the childbirth. And it's the most costly condition during pregnancy and postpartum. I have here compared to gestational diabetes, which is screened regularly in pregnancy, taken care of. You get the extra education, you get the extra visits, and it's $3,000 for gestational diabetes, and it's $17,000 medical costs, PMAD related. So, and the maternal costs include the productivity loss, maternal health expenses, and OB-related expenses. I'm going to move on. So our PMAD project, our county project, was started with our beloved Kathy Grimmel. If you were familiar with her, she passed away last year. She's a maternal child public health nurse. Her and Sandra Miskovich kind of cohorted this project and this vision, and I was lucky enough to join them in this project. So our PMAD project is a systems change initiative. If you'll read on the slide, it's a unique project where we took a broad and a deep view of what was going on in the community with our collaborative partners, which is our local hospitals, French, Sierra Vista, Twin Cities, CHC Women's Health, pediatricians' offices. We're diving into the ER to see what's going on there. And so we have this collaborative group with mental health providers as well. And so it's a system change initiative with partner organizations to create a seamless system of care from preconception, before somebody is even pregnant, to the time when they return to work or their first year after the birth of a child. And so we, with all these partners, we went in and we looked at what was going on with their practice currently. So we looked at their systems, and what are systems? They're the practices within an organization that guide their daily operations. So OB offices, what are all the OB offices doing, and where are they at with screening for mood disorders or depression? Are they educating their patients? Do they use a validated screening tool? Do they have brochures? Is their staff educated? And we found that everybody was kind of doing something different at different places, and they all had great intentions, but some weren't using a validated tool, and some had been using a validated tool for years. And the same with hospitals. Some hospitals had been screening for quite a while, but they didn't have staff educated, or some hospitals, Sierra Vista, wasn't screening currently at all. And so they started from scratch. They jumped on board and created a whole protocol for screening and what to do after French and Twin, I think, had been screening for a little while before that. And so they jumped on board to get support groups and staff educated, and kind of we all followed up together and started from scratch with the plan. So like it says there, we looked at everybody's strengths, their gaps, their needs, and mapped out where to start. And we used the ESPERT framework to implement, and that's screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. So we wanted everybody to screen with a validated tool. And so everybody pretty much is using the Edinburgh. All the hospitals are using the same, the OB offices. And so the idea is that the patient ideally will be screened during pregnancy or postpartum, but they have that screening done, they have a conversation, they're educated, they might be suffering, but the first time they screen, they're not going to disclose that because it's a very shameful problem. Mental health is full of shame. And so we think, okay, if they're screened in the OB office, then they go to the hospital and they're screened after their delivery. They're hearing this a second time. They're hearing the education, the importance of it. And so with each opportunity to screen these people, we hope that they'll learn to take that stigma off and take the shame off and learn why it's so important and why we care, and hopefully disclose something at some point and get the care they need. In our project, we have always emphasized data. Some of my project folks that have been in the project with me for a long time are probably sick of hearing about the importance of data. Without data, we can't prove the hard work that everybody is doing in this screening. And so we have jumped on board with data. Data drives decision-making is what we say. And so Sierra Vista has a monthly data collection. IT runs a report. It's a very structured system. Twin Cities is jumping on board as well with that and going to be collecting data regularly, and French has something that they can pull from their system as well. So we're doing great on data, and I hope that we continue to do so we can prove the good work that we're doing. On to my next slide. And so I do have a little bit of our local data that I got from the MEHA survey, and San Luis Obispo County was positive for postpartum depressive symptoms. They had 10.7%. The Central Coast region was 19.8%, and both of those were high for the state average when we started this project. Sierra Vista, for a year, we had screened 1,100 roughly, and our positive percentage of those was 10.8%. And you can see French was 653 and 5.2%. And Twin Cities will have their data collection, and we'll get back to you with that if we're back. And with these screenings, and I'll keep it brief, we don't expect a ton of positive screenings in the hospital, but like I said, we're screening no matter what, and so these people get that education and see that screening tool again, and hopefully disclose that if in the postpartum period they develop those symptoms or those issues. So with our county project, our needs that I've listed here, we really need to continue to get our providers trained. OB providers, pediatricians, or emergency department physicians educated on PMAD, the umbrella, the spectrum of disorders. And so they know and they're aware on how to treat and diagnose these women correctly and prescribe correctly. I think that from all the office visits that I've done with our OBs and our pediatricians, that they're very open to that and they care about what they're doing and really want to continue their education. the communication loop kind of goes with that, is that we want to create a relationship with our behavioral health and our medical, even our primary care providers and our OBs, so that they all have a warm handoff for these patients and that care isn't missed in between, that they have a list of people that they can call and they're familiar with and they know will take good care of their patients. And we need continual awareness with our project. This is a long-term project that we're happy to have long-term because we want quality. So we want to continue this general outreach and education to HR offices, employers, mom support groups, to just get everybody more aware, to get more support for people that need it. And our ultimate goal is integration of our medical and behavioral health. Solutions. Solutions. Our PMAD project is part of these solutions, and the work that we've done are solutions to these needs. I gave a handout that you may have. There are new laws supporting PMAD. And from July 2019 to January now, there's been three bills that have been passed. One is for OB offices to have screen, you know, they have a requirement that they are screening patients. And the two other bills are involving hospital physician education and hospital programs for patient education and for staff also as well. So those are the bills that have passed, and you can read more about those on the page. Validated screening within the hospitals. We all are screening. We're all doing great with that, and we want to continue that care. Solution, hospital and office staff members are trained regularly in PMAD so that everybody is aware of what they are and what to do with patients they come across in need. PSI training. PSI is our Postpartum Support International. They're somewhat of a gold standard for PMAD training and education. And so we did host a local training in May of 2017 or 18, I believe. But we had over 100 or 200 penny. I don't know if you can quote on how many people were at that training or not, but we had a very successful training that the PMAD project hosted. We had hosted a support group facilitation training, and we have since developed, I know, two or three support groups from that, and we had different entities, mental health providers as well, that were there to develop these support groups. We have a local Postpartum Support International coordinator with a warm line, and so she's a resource to patients, and they can get her number and they can call her at any time, and she'll call and be a voice to help them and help them with resources as well. We have a county PMAD website, pmadslow.org, with tons of resources and an Edinburgh screening tool. And the NAVSLOW resource guide is a guide with a ton of resources, but it has a PMAD-centered couple pages with the local therapists and psych providers that have been trained specifically in PMAD. And we have a provider-to-provider training that we are putting on in March of this year, and that is a prescriber's training. We have two speakers, and our hope is to get our OBs, our pediatricians, our ED department doctors, and our behavioral health all together in one room to get an education on PMAD and to come together, form relationships, and all meet each other just to be together and learn about it. So we're excited about that. In our advanced training certification for Postpartum Support International will be May 2020, and that's another training for a certification in PMAD mental health. And then another solution is general awareness that we'll just continue on to spread awareness through the county. And that's it for me. Thank you for listening, and thank you again for having me.
Thank
thank you for bringing in the information. I'm sure we'll have some questions for you later.
Okay, I will just jump in with the number that was asked. 120 individuals in this county have been certified. Very impressive number.
Yes, it's good. Okay, Calandra.
Hi, my name is Calandra Park. I am a, I wear multiple hats of dignity. I am a mother baby nurse and part-time, and I also do this part-time perinatal mental health coordination. It's a newer role at Dignity, and we're really excited about it. So thank you for the opportunity to allow me to present today. I will begin by sharing a little bit of the background as to where Dignity kind of, or how Dignity came to where it's at right now. So just really quickly, I won't go into too much history. But in 2015, perinatal mental health became a priority. It was born out of a corporate board priority setting sort of initiative. And so just to give an example in some context, one of the board members is a, what's the team? The 49ers. I'm not from California, so I have to think twice about these teams. Sorry. Is an executive with the 49ers, and his priority was traumatic brain injury, understandably. So another priority was human trafficking, which you may see Dignity Health associated with pretty often. And another one, there's five total, and another one was perinatal mental health. At the time, it was just postpartum depression, but that has now expanded to include some of the other disorders that Brooke briefly mentioned. So from that priority setting, there was a decision made to kind of focus on a community needs assessment down in Santa Maria, primarily at Marion Regional Medical Center. Given its unique population, Dignity kind of thought it would be an interesting place to kind of take a look at the needs and, you know, see what's happening and just how to move forward from there. The following year and for the next couple years, the momentum was maintained by a stakeholder group, and it was primarily quarterly meetings where we kind of came together and talked about the needs and what we could do, what we needed to do. We were minimally screening women at the time only because we didn't want to screen and have nowhere to send women because that would be completely unethical. And I'm delighted to share that in 2020, or basically the end of 2019, like I said, we started this patient navigation program where yours truly is now dedicated to helping navigate patients from identification all the way through treatment and ongoing support. So I think several people have already touched on this, so I won't go into it too much, but there were two recent laws that were passed focusing on the screening, insurance companies, and the hospital's requirements to train and screen and inform patients. So just an overview of my presentation. I call it the program goals, but the overview or the presentation really is going to focus on who are we helping, how are we helping, and why are we helping. So the who is focused on identifying women with mental health needs. The how are we helping is we're linking women to additional services such as support groups, counseling, psychiatrists for medication support. And why are we doing this? We want to improve access to mental health care. Ultimately to improve the health of the woman, the family, the community, and so on. I'll go into a little bit more data later, but that's just a general overview. So the next slide is risk factors, which I think the doctor went over, but I'll just highlight a few. Like I said, there's perinatal loss is a big, you know, understandably risk factor, teen pregnancy, domestic violence, limited resources. If you can't take care of your baby or yourself, you're going to be all very stressed out and you're already tired and exhausted. So that also can kind of lead to PMD. Just as a side note, there is a movement to change the name from PMAD to PMD, just to kind of move away from that the association with MAD. But like some people have said already, PMDs are the most common complication related to pregnancy. So just wanted to reinforce that there are many risks. This next slide is just an image of the educational brochure that we give to our patients at Dignity Health, both at French and at Marion. It comes in English and Spanish, and it's titled Speak Up When You're Feeling Down. Happy to share a copy of that if anybody's interested. And then again, the next slide is just the Dignity Health version of the same screening tool, the EPDS tool that others have also highlighted. I do want to kind of point out Question number 10. This is a critical question. The thought of harming myself has occurred to me. If anybody ever screens positive for this, it's an immediate crisis, and we move very quickly once they've been identified. It's a widely used screening tool. It's pretty much the go-to, so you may hear of Mr. Edinburgh pretty often. The next slide here is just about the process of screening. So my presentation is really focusing on the individual. We've done a lot of macro level, but I want to kind of drill down into the individual. So we're screening women at least once during pregnancy, ideally, to kind of get a baseline, and then we're going to screen again after pregnancy. Symptoms don't necessarily appear for several weeks after pregnancy. So like Brooke said, we're starting in the hospital and we're priming women to understand what these symptoms are and what these questions are and what we're looking for and how we ultimately want to support them if they do screen positively. So in the center is really the focal point of the screening. So during the OB is the one who's going to have the presumably the most contact or consistent contact immediately after pregnancy. But you'll see that the visits surrounding the OB are also great opportunities to screen women. The well baby visits, the pediatrician, women or moms may not take care of themselves, but they usually, not always, but usually will take care of their baby. They'll take them to their visits. So that's another opportunity at the pediatrician visits. There's the primary care visits, because sometimes the OB, if they don't, once you have your baby, the OB is kind of more or less ready to kind of pass you on. Not in a bad way, but that's just how it works. So after 6 or 8 weeks, if you've had an uncomplicated pregnancy, you're going to kind of move on to see your primary care physician. And so we have been trying, as Brooke mentioned, to reach out to primary care providers as well, and just to bring their attention to the urgency behind perinatal mood disorders. And also, like Brooke said, emergency department and the urgent care clinics, we've been reaching out to those as well. What I want to do highlight, though, is the question on the right. We really want to train providers to ask, have you had a baby in the last year? So when Christy went to the ED, at some point we needed to have the emergency doctor, room doctor ask, have you had a baby in the last year? And kind of dig into that and open up a different conversation, maybe. Next slide is just a quick overview of the professional recommendations. So with increased awareness, professional bodies have also come out with their own official recommendations and guidance for their providers. So you'll see ACOG is the OB body, and AAFP are family physicians. They recommend screening at least once during pregnancy, and then the AAP is the pediatric group, and they recommend screening at every well baby visit during the first year. I did want to mention, I think last year there was a strong recommendation put out by ACOG to actually bump up the initial postpartum visit to 2 to 3 weeks, in part because maternal mortality or maternal health is a crisis in this country, but it's also to identify, additional complications beyond like preeclampsia and gestational diabetes and things like that, but also for these exact mental health issues that we're talking about today. So that's another reason why follow-up visits have been recommended to be at 2 to 3 weeks. Okay, so this next slide, it kind of gets down to the granular, but I'll try to simplify it. But basically, each of those 10 questions is scored with 0, 1, 2, or 3 points. You add up all the points, and the higher the score, the higher the risk. If it's over 10, you are at risk for depression and or anxiety. And at that point, ideally, you would notify the provider so that they are aware. If the woman scores higher than 13, that's a positive screen. This is not a diagnostic tool, so it's just a screening, and it just brings the awareness, and it mobilizes and galvanizes what needs to be done. So those that score over 13, they are likely suffering from depression and or anxiety. Like I mentioned on question 10, if they admit to thoughts of harming themselves, that is an immediate crisis. The next slide, it's a lot of text and color coordination, but essentially I'll focus on the yellow and the orange. So again, anyone who scores over 10 is offered basic resources and asked, do you want to see somebody? We want to put the question out there because, The screening is not a perfect tool, so we just want to have opportunities to start conversations and to engage women when we need to. If their score is over 13, we are just going to give them the resources and recommend that they see somebody. What Dignity Health is doing is I am actually going to be that person that comes in and meets with these women and asks them, how are you doing? What can I do for you? What are your biggest needs? Do you want to see a therapist? Do you want to see a psychiatrist for medication? I mean, obviously in conjunction with their OB and their medical provider, we're trying to prevent them from getting lost in the mental health system, which is really tough to navigate, especially when you're just not motivated to do anything else, right? So that's my role, is to kind of be that backstop and to fill the gap between the OB and the patient, and not just the OB, even the primary care providers. So this is an image sort of where the care manager, it's a slide from the Council on Patient Safety and Women's Health. So the care manager, Dignity calls it a patient navigator, but that we are the go-between the mental health provider, their primary care provider, and the actual patient. So it's just a stopgap measure, and it's really there to make sure that this patient is followed through the entire continuum and gets what she needs. Ideally, so some of this starts actually inpatient in the hospital, but Dignity is committed to supporting women both outpatient and not just Dignity Health patients. So it is a community service and a commitment that Dignity has to help women find the services that they need. They're very committed to it. They have put a lot of resources behind it. And so this is something that Dignity is committed to. I'll just stop there. The next slide is a quick sort of, decision tree for the management of PMD. So as I've been talking very quickly, I know, screening starts there. And then if they're identified from mild to moderate and then moderate to severe, you'll sort of see some of the options for management. So a lot of it is the therapy and the medication that others have talked about. You see the moderate to severe. There are intensive outpatient programs, thankfully, here in SLO and Santa Barbara County. There is also inpatient hospitalization options. It's a lot harder now to get into those, but it is an option. There are not very many perinatal psychiatric programs in the country, but there are some, and there's, I think, one or two in California. So this basically is the map that I'm helping navigate patients through, and that we have all the providers rallying around. I'll go back to the spectrum that everyone's been talking about of perinatal mental health disorders. It's not just depression and anxiety. There is the panic disorder, OCD, PTSD, psychosis is a very serious condition. What I will say here is that I want to note that all of these are delineated with the word postpartum. So they're distinctly different than sort of the more generalized OCD and PTSD, the generalized OCD and panic disorder. A lot of those thoughts, as Christy shared, are about your baby or how you're going to harm your baby and things like that. So it's specifically identified as a postpartum psychosis or a postpartum PTSD, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so Brooke highlighted this, and I can't help. I worked in public health for 20 years, so I need to include this kind of information about policy. $14.2 billion, expenses to society for untreated PMATs. Half of women are not even diagnosed or get the treatment that they need. This slide and the next slide basically demonstrate why we're doing this. It has an impact on the mom, the baby, the family, the community, the society. We look at the societal impact here. The cost per mother, $19,520. Each child, $12,000. What are those impacts look like? Pretty, again, Brooke already went over these, but I'll just, reiterate productivity loss, not contributing at work, having a hard time working less, health expenditures. There are longer hospital stays, risk for suicide. A lot of these women, in part related to the productivity loss, are, maybe accessing more disability, WIC, and other services from the government. And then for the child, if the mother's mental health is not strong and stable, there's higher risk for preterm birth, their own behavioral and developmental disorders, higher risk of injury and emergency room visits, higher risk for asthma, obesity, SIDS, breastfeeding becomes a challenge, and here it actually says that there are less pediatrician visits that are made. Okay, and just one more slide, again, just kind of underscoring the earlier that we intervene, obviously the more protective it is for the mother, the child, and the family unit. It is the most common complication, and we want to make sure that we support our moms and their families as effectively as possible. That's why screening is so important, so that we can identify these women and know who they are. They may not verbally state how they're doing, but that screening tool sometimes is an effective way for women to kind of express the thoughts that are in their head. And I can tell you from working in the hospital that you can talk to them and they'll just nod and they'll say yes and, you know, say everything's okay, but then they come back with a score of 18, which is really high, and it's a totally different story. And they use that as their own way to just open up a conversation. They might not be able to articulate it verbally, but they can identify it on paper. So if there's not enough intervention, or if it's there's none at all, there's 50%, we'll have obviously adverse effects and multi-generational consequences. I kind of borrowed a line, and I forgot to give credit here, but I borrowed a line from Postpartum Support International on the bottom. It says here that mothers need to know that they're not alone, they're not to blame, and that with help they will be well, because they will. They will be well with help. There are studies, and it's evidence-based that the management of postpartum depression does have positive results and outcomes. So we're all rallying around that and supporting our moms and our babies as much as we can. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, Michelle. And then we'll start with the questions.
Okay, sounds good. Right, I don't have any groovy slides, but sorry about that. But I do have some handouts, so I'm going to hand one.
I'm Michelle Whitaker from Twin Cities Hospital. I work as a lactation consultant. I'm also a nurse and a childbirth educator there. In 2016, I also got to be part of the PMAT project along with Brooke and our lovely Kathy, who's no longer here. And it was really exciting to see stuff, to identify how to help women in our county. At the same time, working at Twin, we do the Edinburgh scale also on all the moms after birth. When that happens at our hospital and that's triggered, that automatically gets a medical social work visit to the mom in the room. And as a lactation consultant, I always talk with the mom, how do you feel? Go over how baby blues with them and how the placenta, when it's born, takes a nosedive off the pier, their hormones go. It's going to be a few weeks so they feel better. They can cry really easy, but in that third week, if they're still feeling really funky, you know, it's really a chemical imbalance. And so we have a chance as lactation consultants to really talk with the moms. So that being said, three of us, the medical social worker, Shelley Blanc, who's not here tonight, she's sick, and another postpartum nurse, Sandy Dish, and I all said, gosh, Shelley suffered severely from anxiety postpartum. Sandy had severe postpartum depression and needed medications, and I had post-traumatic birth syndrome, which is what kind of like PTSD, but a really traumatic birth, which I see on the birthing floor a lot. Moms have a hard time recovering from their expectations of birth and what they thought it would be. Anyways, we said, let's start a support group. So our good OB director at that time, Shireen Taylor, said, yeah, go for it. So we did. 2 weeks later, we started the first support group in San Luis Obispo County in 2016 in October. In November of 2016, the county, who data and data were always really confusing for me at the time, didn't know how important data was. I thought data was someone from Star Trek. So that being said, finding out how data drives us getting grants in our county by our zip codes, and it triggers the moms that are at risk in the state, and we get money. So they paid for us to go to the PSI conference in November of 2016. So since we've started that group, we meet once a week on Thursdays from 10 to 11:30. We've been doing it, it's all year round, unless it runs on a major holiday. We have seen 250 support groups. 75 moms have come through our support groups. 150 moms have been screened and referred out that we have seen on the floor that did not come to group but have been invited to group. Like currently today, when I was doing lactation on the floor, I talked to a mom. Always what happens is we look at their history. They'll trigger because they had a prenatal visit. that they did the Edinburgh scale. They're depressed. They have a history of anxiety or depression. Right there, I look at it and I go, oh, here's a mom with that. So I go and I talk with her and I say, how's it going? How did you, when they had another baby, the mom I saw today, third baby, she said she suffered from postpartum depression on the first baby. And the second baby also. She suffered in silence on the first one. The second one, she got on medications. And this one, she said, I want to come to your support group. I want to get on medications right away. And I want to feel better. So there is so much help out there for moms that are at risk. So our support group, we, the moms, talk about how they feel. We normally have somewhere between 3 to 7 mommies. They bring their babies. They talk about their week, how their week went. We usually have a planned event. For example, we'll have a little calendar, and we'll plan it out what we might be talking about. But that can really morph with each group, because sometimes they'll come in, the whole theme is they're so anxious. Couldn't sleep, up all night. Is my baby breathing? So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about coping mechanisms. Usually the medical social worker, who is key in these support groups, she'll do a lot of psychosocial bits. We'll talk about how they can work and cope with those feelings. A lot of lactation comes up. So I do teach the childbirth classes. And then on the fourth class, which is postpartum period, I always talk about baby blues and postpartum depression. And I'll say, you know, if you're the eyes and ears, I talk about their partner who's with them for mama. If she's not feeling good, not taking interest in that baby around that third week, second week, call me. Call me at the lactation hotline. We got a hotline at lactation. Let me know. Just I have him come in clinic. So I had this dad. He called up. He goes, Michelle, she's just not the same. She's not the same as she was. I'm calling you because you told me to do that. So I had him come right into clinic. And that triggers that whole team approach. I called her OB and said, I have so-and-so in the office. She had her baby on such and such a date. She's your client. I really think she needs to be seen. She came to support group. She did get on medications. She started feeling better. And we help network. We use that navigating slow. It's like a big workbook and a lot of really good resources in the county. But we helped her get into a counselor to get one-on-one counseling. So most moms get better with one-on-one counseling, medications, and support groups. So anyways, our support group, our mission for our support group is to support women in Slo County who are experiencing emotional difficulties and isolation related to motherhood in a safe and confidential environment. We provide group support connecting moms through shared experiences and knowledge. This is a mom-to-mom group, not therapy. Psychoeducation from a licensed clinical social worker and registered nurses with postpartum support international certifications, collaboration with community resources and educational materials. So we also do crafts, deep breathing and relaxation, do a lot of lactation stuff a lot. We have a one-on-one lactation clinic at Twin Cities, and we've been very, very blessed to have a really good OB director right now, Mary Jo Cascarelli, with a big green light, go for it. So if someone triggers in lactation clinic where they have that breastfeeding help, they're crying, they're seem very detached from their baby, they're having breastfeeding issues. Breastfeeding issues are huge on a postpartum depression and coping. Moms, so the average age of the mom in group is 29 years old. She's a hardworking mom. She's usually a professional. We have a lot of moms in their 30s, type A, professional moms, used to being in control, and they have a baby. Well, the baby didn't get the memo that, you know, there's no control with the baby, and he's going to get them up all the time, and they're not going to get any sleep, and life is turned upside down. So those moms really are so high risk, and they come in, and the biggest one is anxiety, which is harder to treat than depression. It's way up there. So if they had that anxiety prior to pregnancy, it just gets worse in pregnancy and rears its ugly head in that postpartum period. And those moms, you can just see them on the floor in the hospital. They're holding their baby like this. Not close, but they're really stiff with it, and they're looking at it, and it's like, what is this? And those moms, we look at them and go, okay, we got to keep a really close eye on that mom. So we do follow-up phone calls on every single mommy that's discharged from Twin Cities. Call them up within a day or two of discharge. How are you doing? How are you feeling? remind them about support groups. Every single mom or baby-friendly hospital needs to be know about a support group anyways, whether it's breastfeeding or emotional support. So I think we have really good follow-up. We're working really hard. This is our third year. We had our third-year anniversary in October last year of starting our support group. So good turnout. And the results, because we do keep data, we're a little looser. We keep it on paper. So of our data, 50% had postpartum depression, 60% had anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorders. 33% reported having PTSD. We do a little survey. So when each mom comes to a group, they get a folder, and it has questionnaires in it and a lot of pamphlets. And we do a follow-up, so they have a pre-test when they start and a post-test. And so with the post-test, 100% of the moms have said they've had that their symptoms have decreased. So we've had really good outcomes. Most of the moms will stay until they go back to work. Many of the moms have come back for their second baby, have had the same symptoms. So I think that's it. So,
good. Right, thank you so much for sharing your program, Hope, with us. So we will start with questions from the commissioners. I'm going to ask one just very quickly before anybody else. It was a slide that Calandra shared with us, but I'm going to ask Angela the question. And it was the one where ACOG, AAFP, and then the Association of Pediatricians suggested that we screen at each well baby visit. So in our society today, when our moms go back to work, and sometimes our dads or somebody else brings the little one in for the well visit, is there some way that the pediatricians do a little bit of screening?
So since I'm an OB and I don't really see much of the pediatrician side, mm-hmm. I can't really speak for what pediatricians do. I could certainly.
So would that be an area that we're lacking in, or maybe Brooke? Maybe that by bringing the pediatricians in to be a stakeholder with your group to do some training on that?
Yeah, we do have them included in our collaborative project. Mm-hmm. Our priority has been the hospitals and the OBs, but I do round on the pediatricians' offices and give them in services, and they are aware of the screening. Mm-hmm. And some offices do screen, and some are thinking about it and open to it. They do some use a validated tool, and some will say they do it in their own way and they check on mom, but they don't mm-hmm. use a validated tool. And so mm-hmm. it's a work in progress, but they are included in that.
Well, it's one of those things as we see the dynamics of our society changing and see others bringing baby in for their, and having done that for a couple of grandchildren.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I did want to touch on, I meant to mention in my presentation is that significant others, spouses, fathers are not immune to this depression either. The 1 in 10 fathers can get, or statistically do get, depression as well. So really, they should be screening the significant other or the spouse as well in the pediatrician's office if they're going to screen the mom. So I just wanted to speak on that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Other commissioners that might have questions?
Commissioner Sage, if you don't mind my jumping on your comment, because I was so sure you were going to the same place as me. I was seeing her nodding. That was the exact slide that I was going to ask about.
Oh, yeah.
And we can put our OB physician on the spot. She can't control ACOG, but it really stunned me to see that the recommendation for ACOG was to do a prenatal screen, but not a postpartum screen. So is that true, that ACOG does not have a universal recommendation that at the postpartum visit that there should be standardized screening?
No, it's recommended at the postpartum visit.
Okay, that's what I thought. I'm sorry, Calandra, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it also would be interesting. I think that this is wonderful news to hear about the postpartum visit being moved up to 2 weeks from the 6 weeks. Is that in addition to a six-week visit?
So, like, it's actually not really clear. Like, there's not really a full, like, ACOG doesn't specifically say, like, do that in place of the other. It's still recommended to see people at 6 weeks just because a lot of, like, the changes that happen with pregnancy really sort of start to resolve more fully at 6 weeks. And so what most people are doing is that everyone still keeps their six-week postpartum visit, but people have a very low threshold of seeing people back sooner in addition to the six-week visit. So if someone has depression, for example, or has any questions about mood, then they'll come back in a week or two for a mood check and just check in and see how they're doing. And then basically with other patients, like, we just have a very low threshold of having them come back for a quick check-in before the six-week postpartum visit.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I think I see that actually in my business and with the OBs that I work with. They really are doing two-week postpartum checks now, a majority of them, in addition to the 6 weeks. Okay. All right. Starting down with Candace.
All right. Christy, I just wanted to thank you so much for telling your story. I think it's really important to hear from the people that are affected, and it was great of you to share that with us. I think that's lovely. Thank you. My question, I think I thought of while Brooke was presenting, but it, probably any of you could answer, which is, and you alluded to it sometimes, you're doing amazing work getting all of these different people together, and I know that's not easy. And I guess I wanted to know or hear a little bit more about what challenges you see uniquely in the county. What would you, if you could do anything right now, like what would that be, and how could we help you with that?
I'm going to wait for everybody. I'll go first.
Okay.
Just to touch on that, the challenges I see are the differences in care in practices, and so you kind of just have to roll with what's working for one office and work with them, and then move on to the next and they're doing something different, but just roll with what they're doing and help them. My wish would be that we could get some kind of dedicated bed for a mom in need in our county. I feel like that's a big missing link, maybe, to somebody that might need it, and the integration with the behavioral health and our medical health. That would be my biggest hope.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Does anybody else have any other challenges that they wanted to speak about?
I just want to address one of our biggest needs. Also, what Brooke is saying is our SenCal moms. We have no psychiatrist for SenCal moms. Mm-hmm. If you're private insurance, we have like one, Shannon Easton Carr. She works part-time. We have some nurse practitioners that do mental health prescriptions. OBs can do them. But if you're SenCal, even the inpatient place down in Santa Barbara Ventura will not take them. They have to go to Los Angeles. Okay, so our moms at some of the highest risks have the least amount of care. And then our Hispanic moms are really at risk, and we have almost nobody for them. So that's a big need in our county.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And Brooke, excuse me, Brooke, thank you. I was interested in the statistic or the data that 1 in 5 women in the United States. It seems low to me, just based on the experience of being a supervisor and having some of these young mothers come back to work after 6 weeks and them crying in my office. It's just a horrible thing. And in my perfect world, we would be more like Europe, where they give them, a year off to start to nurture those babies and bring them to the point where they maybe feel a little bit more comfortable about leaving their babies. And I wonder if you talk to them about if any of the counseling involves mothers having to be separated from their babies at a point where they're just learning how to be a mom.
Yeah, I think that that's a big change from 40, 50 years ago, too, is when you have your family that lives next door to you as well, and you don't have to go to work, or if you do, you have mom or grandma next door to take care of the baby. So I completely agree with that. It's a hard, especially in our county, too, as well.
Well, and I just wonder if that is an exacerbating factor in a depression that may be not rearing its head until after.
Yeah,
I guess. Go back to work.
Can you speak to that?
Sorry, what was the question?
I think it's an additional, what I would consider, blow or risk factor. Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of different risk factors that I think make moms depressed, mm-hmm. and that would definitely be a big one at that time. It's a huge stressor that you're just like waiting for on the calendar, counting off the days. So I do think so, but I don't know if somebody else can speak more to that.
I mean, I'll make a comment.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just make a comment. I think, you know, postpartum depression and anxiety, it can show up at month 9. So whether the overwhelming situation or circumstances show up when you go back to work or whether something happens down the road, I mean, I think all of that exacerbates just the basic underlying transition to motherhood, whether it's your first child or your third child or fifth child. And I do also want to echo what Michelle said there, you know, having spent the last maybe couple months looking around for mental health support for moms, the culturally sensitive services for our mostly Spanish-speaking moms, but not all, is severely lacking. The lack of insurance coverage, the lack of providers who are on these panels, you know, and limiting the access, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is also a big challenge too. So, I mean, those are exacerbating factors, you know what I mean? So you're trying to get back to work, you're trying to take care of your new baby and trying to do a good job at work. You want to, you know, you want to put on a strong front for, you know, everyone everywhere, and it just piles on. And so, like I think Brooke was demonstrating, the burden just is overwhelming and you're just going to land on the floor. Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation. I'm in the thick of it. I've got a 7-month-old at home, second time around. First time around was a little bit more difficult for a lot of reasons, but postpartum depression being one of them. And the second time around, being a little more proactive about it, it certainly does help and makes a big difference. So thank you for the care that you're providing to people in the county. And thank you so much for sharing your story. I don't really have a question as much as just, you know, ideas of ways to continue to do better for women and families in the county. It would be, I think a lot of times it can be difficult to, even when you're, so I'm a social worker by training, so when you're also handing out resources to clients, you know, when you have so many people to see in a day, the percentage of those who actually take those resources and make that phone call and try and, you know, find someone or find help, or even women who may not have a primary care provider because things are always changing and shifting in the county with care, it would be wonderful to be able to have that follow-up. And I know that some of you are doing that in terms of actually picking up the phone and calling up your caseload a week later, 2 weeks later. But I do think that something like that would be helpful to do for families. And I'm not quite sure about the AAP recommendation, whether or not that's happening. I think that would be great to do. And if there is a way that we can continue to encourage our pediatrician offices, especially for those who may not have implemented it yet, it would be great to, if there's a way for us to be able to support you in doing that and encouraging those providers to do so, I can't speak for the entire commission, I guess, officially, but I think we would certainly like to help do that. I do think that that would be another great place to be able to catch families in need, especially at that every checkup. So those just really more comments than anything, but thank you for your work.
I don't have any additional questions. I want to thank everybody for their presentations. Ongoing awareness is key in any way we can be of help. I think that's our goal.
Thank you, presenters. That was great. As a dietitian in the Women's Health Clinic, I'm not screening them. I work with them, more focusing on gestational diabetes. But as I work, I hear a lot in the background about postpartum depression. And this was a great way for me to really learn about the comprehensive approach in treating. So I really appreciate it. My question was already addressed. And thank you, Christy, for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you all very much. This was really great. And I do have a few questions. I just had a thought about, are women more at risk if they've already have had an issue with OCD or depression before they become pregnant? Could somebody speak to that? I mean, just simply because our audience needs to, they don't see the nodding heads.
Absolutely. Women who've had depression are absolutely at an increased risk of postpartum depression. And women who've had postpartum depression are also at an increased risk of postpartum depression in the future pregnancy. The one statistic I read was that if you've had postpartum depression before, the risk is about 1 in 4 that you get postpartum depression again. And again, all of these numbers are often just hard to really nail just because not everyone reports their symptoms. But there's definitely an increased risk with those.
Thank you.
I'll just add to that. In the inpatient setting, so patients who have been in, whose history reflects anxiety or depression or any other mental health issue, they're immediately flagged for a social work consult immediately, regardless of their screening. So it's a definite risk factor.
Okay, so how do our local therapists then play into working with their clients? Is there some interfacing there to educate them, to educate women before they get pregnant, if that's going to be something they do?
I don't know about before they're pregnant. I don't know, Brooke, if you want to add to this. But, I mean, that's sort of the role of the patient navigator is to do that warm handoff, if not complete, face-to-face handoff and connect women who are looking for a therapist but just don't have the wherewithal to find one. I will link them to somebody, and I will talk to the therapist. I'll have the appointment set up and then just set the relationship up. And if I have to walk the patient over to the office, I will do that. That's ultimately what, in an ideal situation, if that needs to happen, it will.
Well, I've worked a lot in the substance abuse field and prevention, and that's where my questions are coming from. So are we working with, say, the local therapist groups to make them aware of how severe this can be, and so that they are letting women know, oh, you're at high risk if you get pregnant, that you could suffer from postpartum depression, which is a very serious thing. So keep that in mind. And, just as educating that group of providers, and along with that, in the high school health curriculums, is that ever woven into that? It's like, well, we'll wait till they're pregnant and now suffering from it, when in fact we could say, and someday when you're pregnant, you need to be aware that this is something that could be very serious, just so that all women.
Yeah, I mean, just to answer your first question, so for some reason I stopped my presentation 2 slides early, but I sat down and I said there's more.
So the trainings that we put on a training back in October to train and, again, galvanize the mental health community to become educated in PMDs, it's the same training that the county put on 3 years ago. And they were both filled to capacity. There was a waiting list and all that. I know that I personally reached out to the MFT, the NASW chapter, the Psychological Association. So, the word was put out. We did have a lot of people come back and express interest. They couldn't all make it. I also put out another call for therapists who are willing to work with this population, and I have to tell, the response has been fairly positive. Are they trained? I don't know, but they're interested and they're dedicated, and I'll work with that, and that's fine. So I'm pretty sure that probably happened 3 years ago as well. So we're doing our best to engage. It's hard, though. There's so many, and they're sort of all over the county, and they all work in their little offices that are in like every corner and pocket of the county. To your second question, I will say also for teenage parents or teenage moms, they are also an immediate social work consult, understandably. So with that, they are also higher risk for PMD as well. So certainly, I don't know about it being in a generalized high school health curriculum, but certainly if the teenage girl is, obviously if she's pregnant, then it'll be addressed. It should be, ideally. Okay.
Yeah. I was just going to add to that, too, is with our trainings that we've put on with the local therapists, that's the idea behind it, is that we get these therapists trained and specialized in this little pocket of mental health. And so when they do have these patients before they have their babies, that they are educated and trained to tell their patients about that. And the high school pregnancy or health education curriculum is part of our general awareness and outreach. Is another additional kind of link to that we will try to get to. It's a great idea.
Great.
Yeah, thank you.
And is the new crisis stabilization unit something that's helpful for some of the moms?
It could be. It's an 8-bed unit. Right. And there's if there's a bed available and it's appropriate, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you for a wonderful program. We appreciate every single one of you being here with us. We thank you for sharing the story and for what you're doing for the residents in the county. So, and thank you, Ginger, for putting the program together. It was great. We'll turn to Dr. Borenstein for the health agency report now.
Okay, thank you. So now for something completely different. That's a few infectious disease things to just mention to you that are going on. So flu is still going gangbusters, and we've had our first death that we should be doing a media release on probably tomorrow, but you're getting a sneak preview. Happens every year. It's not that unusual, but we use it as a way to remind the community that influenza is not just a really bad cold. So that is happening. There's a couple of other odd things that are out there. One is there's a bad GI illness happening at Yosemite Park. So this is the second year in a row that we've had a major outbreak of what may be norovirus. If you recall, in our county, a bunch of high schoolers went and brought it back. So just if any folks are, thankfully, hopefully, folks are done with their winter break travel, but just to be aware that is happening and doesn't seem to be letting up. So if you're going to Yosemite, be aware of that. And an even more concerning new respiratory disease that has been occurring in one city in China, we're keeping a close watch on because it doesn't yet match any other known respiratory disease. So those of you who have been around for the days of SARS and then MERS and, avian flu, these are the kinds of things that keep public health people awake at night as the new pathogen on the scene that could be the new leading edge of something that none of us have immunity to, and viruses traditionally don't have treatment. So far it seems to be limited just to this one city, Wuhan City in China, but certainly is worth paying attention to. Might amount to nothing, but again, we
don't want to be asleep at the switch if this is our next major outbreak of something new. The budget is upon us. In January is when county departments have to submit their budgets, and I always like to keep the commission informed of whether we're looking at a good year or a bad year or in between. And this year, from the county's perspective in terms of a balanced budget, is looking not so good for us. So we are being asked to submit a significant reduction to our budget going into the fiscal cycle that will start in next July. My hope is that you all spend furiously and fast in the next 6 months, and that our sales tax and vehicle license fees and everything else will save the day. But I just wanted to make you aware of the fact that we are once again looking at budget reductions for the coming fiscal cycle. And that's all I have to report tonight. Thanks.
Any questions for Dr. Bornstein?
I have a quick question, actually. Do you know the respiratory disease in China? Have they shown person-to-person spread?
Good question. No. It appears to be a zoonotic, meaning from an animal to people, but and that is based on just the circumstances of the people that have been affected, that they were at... there's a better word than farmer's market. We have farmer's markets, but they have live farm animals at their markets. And it was in that setting that the disease seems to have been spreading. But so thus far, there has not been any cases of person-to-person spread. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and do commissioner updates. Susan, want to start with you?
Yes, HDOC meets again this coming Wednesday, and we'll know more, but we've been in discussions with the governor's next round of housing funding that's coming down from the state, which is one-time funding. Last time it was called HEAP funding, now it's called HAP funding, but it's all for housing the homeless. And this time the committee had kind of come together, and they're looking at making sure that funding is used to complete the projects like the Paso CARES project. They didn't get full funding to put their navigation center and emergency shelter together, so they want to backfill so that definitely gets completed for this next year. And with this influx of funding, and the next priority is going to be North Coast with Morro Bay and looking to kind of tie them in together for homeless services, Los Osos and Cambria, and all of them working together. And the third one is to look at projects that will provide some new additional housing options that are sustainable, that maybe the clients can come and live there and pay and look at some of the special populations. So those are their general priorities for this next round. And just this last week, I don't know, we have our meeting on Wednesday, so we'll find out more, because it sounds like the governor is putting a lot, even more money towards solving the homeless issue and kind of thinking out of the box. And it seems like that's what we're going to need to do if we're going to get on the other side of this. Because every time you house one, two more get unhoused. So we've got to start coming up with something new. So a lot of activity going on around that. So next month I'll have more to report.
Okay, thank you. Amy?
You attended a Healthy Communities meeting on my behalf, so I was traveling for work, so I'll let you report on that.
Thank you. Ginger?
No update.
Okay. No report. Slow time, I guess. Catherine?
The committees that I sit on were kind of on hiatus over the holidays, so I have nothing to report right now.
Okay.
Candace? The Naloxone Action Team met last week, and our AmeriCorps Vista put together a map of overdose reversals coming out of people that were refilling at the syringe exchange. She was able to put together, I think, over 130 different reversals with naloxone, and showed where all of those were occurring, because we've been asking that for the last 6 months. So it was really interesting data we'll share with you when we report to the commission. And there's going to be a steering committee meeting for the Opioid Safety Coalition next month. So,
good. Thank you. So I did two meetings. I went in Amy's place to the Healthy Communities meeting last Thursday. They had a presentation on the City of SLO's active transportation plan, and what they were, what phase they were in with that. They're actually looking for people to be on that committee, and there is an application. If anybody lives in SLO and would be interested in that, I'll certainly share with you how you get that application. The committee did look at two projects by self-help people's housing, the Tiburon Place, which is in San Luis Obispo, over by Orchid Road, and then the Rolling Hills Phase 3, which is up in Templeton, which is the final and last phase of that, which is right off Los Tablos and Bennett Way. If you're going up towards the hospital, it's on the right-hand side there. And then lastly, they did look at the Cal Poly Master Plan. The draft EIR is done, and they will be submitting some comments towards that. They did want ask me to announce that there is an upcoming public workshop up in Paso to look at the Olson Chandler Ranch specific plan, which we didn't really talk about it at the meeting, but there is an open house on the 15th of January from 3 to 7 if you're interested in that. And I think from what I could tell, it's off of 46 going east, but it's quite a large project. So if we have residents up there and would be interested in going to that, that is open. And then I also, along with Commissioner Campbell, we had an additional meeting of the Tobacco Coalition last week. They gave us some really good data and specifics about a couple of ordinances that are being considered in the county. Tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors, they will be having, is this a reading of an ordinance, Dr. Bernstein, or they're just presenting the ordinance?
Well, there'll be a presentation about draft ordinances for actual consideration by the board to adopt.
Okay. So there are two ordinances, one to ban smoking in all outdoor areas of the county, and the second one is to ban the sale of e-cigarettes, and those were two of the support letters that we presented and consented to send tonight. And then also tomorrow evening, and Commissioner, so I'll go to the board and present our letters. They got kind of long, so I won't be reading them because it's more than 3 minutes, but I'll pick out the main points. And then Commissioner Campbell will be going to the Morro Bay City Council tomorrow evening. They have presented, discussed, represented, and they did take out of their ordinance, there's no longer a prohibition of flavored products, and so we're suggesting that go back in, so he'll represent us there. And that is all that I have. Standing committee reports, legislative, anything, Amy?
Yes. Actually, a piece that's rather important and relevant for tonight. Okay. As of January 1st, 2020, the Mental Health Care for New Moms Act was passed, really spearheaded by the California Task Force on the Status for Maternal Mental Health, really taking steps to address continuous care and mental health in new moms. This will allow new moms who want to keep seeing their same provider, even if out of their network, for up to 12 months.
in the state 12. Of California, which is wonderful. And a second piece, more federal legislation, H.R. 3, which was spearheaded by the California Medical Association, which strongly supports the Lowering Drug Costs Now Act, which is passed in the House of Representatives in late December 2019. This will now authorize Medicare to negotiate prices with drug companies. And the California Medical Association thinks that this bill is one of the most effective efforts to date to reduce costs and improve access. This will have large impacts for our seniors in SLO County who are largely on a fixed income.
Good. Thank you for keeping track of, of those things. Any other committee have anything to report? You can. Nominating?
There are two vacant seats on the Health Commission, and the staff will be submitting Ginger Cochran for reappointment from a direct to a direct provider because she is a dietitian. Things changed over time, and so we will have one vacant consumer seat as well as one vacant direct provider seat available. So anyone who's interested in our community, you know, you can go online and submit an application. Any questions, give us a call.
Okay, thank you. So I will remind you that we decided not to meet in February. And then I realized that there's only one Monday holiday in February this year for whatever reason, but that's all right. So we're dark in February. Our meeting in March, the topic will be prevention health funding. If anybody has any other ideas for future items, please let Mike know. We did go through the rest of the year at the planning meeting in December and come up with quite a few different topics, but we're always open to other topics as well. Any other commissioners have anything else this evening?
Yeah, I do want to say one thing now that you reminded me there's no February meeting. I was going to hold this, but so the whole person care grant that I've mentioned before that the county did now get an allocation. It's going to the board in 2 weeks for them to approve the receipt of something over $800,000 over 5 years. So don't get too excited because when you break that down on a yearly basis, it really amounts to a superhuman that we're going to be looking for to fill a position of a systems navigator to help the most vulnerable folks in our community navigate between systems. So from homeless shelters, hospitals, psychiatric healthcare facilities, basic primary care, et cetera. So there's lots of healthcare navigators and case managers and social workers in all of the different organizations. What we're imagining with this position is it will be the hub to those various spokes. And so if you know anyone who is of a social worker or a really good health administrator or a nurse or anyone who wants to be at the pinnacle of helping navigate our most vulnerable individuals between all the systems, 70 now being one of the other systems, TEMA, et cetera, we're looking to find just the exact right person for that position. Decent salary, as county goes, a program manager, and that will probably be posted in early February, so keep your eyes out. Thanks.
Good. Okay. Susan?
I just wanted to make a comment that the letters that are being sent and given to the Board of Supes were great. A lot of really good information in there, and I think you made a really good case.
Okay, good. Well, we hope they'll be effective. So, all right, anybody else? Jean, did you have anything? No? Okay. All right, we will be adjourned, and we'll see you in March.